Inside the Victoria Club in Queen Street, Melbourne, bookmakers and big punters are meeting to pay off credit bets. It's the week after the Easter Racing Carnival in 1976, and security guards are delivering millions of dollars in cash. A tempting pot of gold for thieves. No one knows exactly how much is taken in the legendary Great Bookie Robbery. Some say it's the equivalent of 40 million in today's dollars. But the gang gets little chance to enjoy its loot because of two cruel and very ruthless brothers, Brian and Les Kane. The Great Bookie Robbery is Australia's largest single hold-up, and its millions in loot attract the city's crime bosses, who are looking for their share. First in line for his cut is Les Kane, a member of the notorious Painters and Dockers Union, whose reign over the Melbourne underworld is at its peak in the 1970s. The union is made up of the toughest of unskilled waterfront labourers, men who take on the filthy, stinking job of cleaning ships in dockyards. It's work that attracts men unable to find employment anywhere else, including those with criminal records.
Certainly the toughest union in Australia. You didn't mess about with painters and dockers from Melbourne under any circumstances. You could finish minus an arm and a leg, or maybe a head.
So they were thugs, they were gunmen, they were assassins, they were murderers, they were robbers, they were, you name it, A1 criminals.
After World War II, these tough men and their trade union become the main criminal force in the city. Rivers of cash flow in from armed robberies, safe breaking, money laundering, and massive tax evasion schemes. The most lucrative of all its rackets is the scam called ghost payrolling.
Ghosting, in waterfront language, means collecting pay packets for men who haven't worked. Hidden cameras film payday at the Australian National Line's web dock.
And they were all registered painters and dockers, but most of them never turned up at the docks, but they were paid.
Union delegates are on hand each payday to collect the extra wages.
Four men working, you know, 12 pay packets, whatever. The pilfering of the cargo and other stuff that went on. So whoever controlled that, it was money for old rope. So it was worth fighting over, and they did fight over it. Whoever controlled the union controlled the rorts on the docks.
Painters and dockers are frequently being murdered, some publicly. Others are kidnapped and killed in secret, their bodies dumped where they'll never be found.
It was well held that some of them were buried beneath the freeway and beneath some building, or out in the bay, or out in the, through the heads in deep water, or through the dim sim machine.
Are you protected in any way?
No.
Do you have any police protection?
No.
Do you carry a gun?
No, certainly not.
One of the most notorious of these murders is that of union leader Pat Shannon, who shot dead in the Druids Hotel in South Melbourne in 1973. Renowned painters and dockers tough man Bill Longley and two other men are convicted of the murder.
I've said it before and I'll say it again. I didn't kill Pat Shannon.
Longley claims rivals have been trying to kill him, including one brazen attack after a union election.
It was outside the union rooms. Oh yeah. I got out of the car there once and there was a car parked in front of mine, then there was a car behind that one. Well, a bloke got out of the third car and he started firing shots at me. Yeah, he let go with about six shots, I reckon. I just kept jumping and hoping and jumping back and forwards and hoping for the best. He must have been a bad shot.
Billy Longley was called the Texan because of his bad habit carrying a six gun, and a huge one, about that big. I don't know what they call them, but it was a huge one.
Over the years, Longley survives more than 20 attempts to kill him by rival union members.
Well, look, my house was bombed once and shards of steel were found as far down as the kitchen, which was, you know, three or four rooms down the passageway.
During the Dockers' bloody reign, as many as 50 men are murdered. In the 1970s, their chief enforcer is a killer who will later be described by his own wife as the most violent man in Australia, Leslie Kane. Les and his brothers Brian and Ray have a violent childhood.
There were three boys and at least one girl. Their father was Reg Kane, who was an old Collingwood scrap metal dealer, very tough, hard-drinking old bloke. I think he brought the boys up to fight a lot, and I think they might have learned to fight early and fight hard.
Brian Kane was just a difficult man, but he was smarter and cleverer and more devious than his brothers. And he was a man to be feared. I've got to stress, he was a man to be feared. Les was to be feared because he was irrationally violent.
The three Kane boys are accomplished boxers who hone their skills in the ring and on the streets of Collingwood and Richmond.
Brian was a Golden Gloves fighter. Les was regarded for his weight as a very good street fighter, a very dangerous street fighter.
Brian and Les become leaders of one of the union's most violent factions.
They and several other of their associates were known as the Richmond Mob. And the Richmond Mob, until the time of the bookie robbery, ran Melbourne.
Detective Paul Higgins, who was once jailed for corruption, had the tough job of tracking the toughest criminals on the city streets.
Brian and Les and Ray always used to get thrown in the mix. But I mean, there was nothing ever that we could ever get for them to actually charge them. I remember that Ray, he was the quieter one of the three of them, although he was still had violent, you know, a violent streak in him.
I knew Brian quite well, and Les I knew particularly well. Les and I suppose you could say we got along like a house on fire. We used to seek my company, Les.
There was a protection fee for looking after people so their shop windows wouldn't get broken in Lygon Street. And, of course, there was a tax that was imposed because they regarded themselves as the lords. And they were like feudal warlords.
One steady source of protection money is from illegal gambling debts, including the city's biggest two-up school, run by Nappy Ollington.
You've got to look at the situation in those days. What was there in Melbourne? There wasn't the amount of restaurants there are today. There was nothing. Now, people wanted somewhere to go. Where can we go? Well, let's go to Nappy's two-up. And it was the tourist attraction of Melbourne at the time. I was smart enough to know the police could close me down overnight if they wanted me. But no, I was too good of a service to them at the time. But the mere fact that people realise that Brian Kane was virtually, what was the word you used, the minder of the game, or the protector, they didn't think twice or four times or ten times about doing anything wrong.
Brian also builds up a reputation as a ferocious debt collector for the illegal off-course SP or starting price bookmakers who flourished in that era.
Brian Kane one day had a debt to collect from a solicitor's office, and he just marched straight in, pulled out an axe, chopped the bloke's desk up, smashed everything on the desk, and the solicitor sat in the corner and he peed his pants. And he paid the debt.
Consorting Squad Detective Brian Murphy has the job of tracking criminal associations inside the Melbourne underworld. He establishes a wary rapport with Brian Kane after they run into each other in a coffee shop.
Then he sat down at the table. He said, "I know who you are." I said, "Good, I know who you are, so that makes us square." The conversation got around to killing people, and Brian Kane said, "I could kill you now. There's not a thing you could do about it." I said, "Well, that's not quite right." I said, "You get them to pull the table away and we'll see how good you are." And I had my police revolver pointed at him under the table. When we pulled the table, he looked at it and he said, "Will you put that away?" I said, "Yeah." So I put it away. And he leaned over and kissed my head. He said, "This is a fucking way copper should be." He said, "They should be ready all the time." We both had a laugh. Actually, I had a sigh of relief.
The brothers stick together and support each other, ready to fight anyone who challenges them.
Les Kane had an unbelievable temper. It turned out later to be part of his downfall.
I witnessed him one day having a fight with a bloke and give him an awful kick, and with shoes that had pointy toes on them, you know, it was terrible. And a few people had to pull him off, the bloke.
Les's terrible temper sees him frequently involved in pointless public fights. He shoots an off-duty policeman in the foot and bashes and almost kills two innocent motorists during a road rage incident. Inevitably, the Canes come up against rivals in the union, and chief amongst them is a notorious armed robber and gunman known as the General, Ray Chuck Bennett. He's the mastermind behind the Great Bookie robbery, and the clash with the Canes is about to become a very public bloodbath. By the late 1970s, the ruthless Painters and Dockers Union has controlled most major crimes in Melbourne for more than 30 years. Dozens have died in the war for control of the union and the proceeds of its crimes from across the city. Leading the pack are killers Les and Brian Kane. Then the stakes are suddenly raised by a cunning criminal named Ray Chuck Bennett.
He actually changed his name from Ray Chuck to Ray Bennett. Chuck was never actually a nickname, really. It was really his original surname.
Even the toughest cops are wary of Bennett.
He, in fact, told me that he was going to kill me. And he said, "I don't care where or when, but one day I'm going to kill you." And I believed him.
Bennett spends time in England, learning from some master criminals. On his return to Melbourne in 1975, he recruits a gang of nine and puts in place meticulous plans for the bookie robbery. He rents an office two floors above the Victoria Club, and it's there that he gathers his gang on the day of the raid. It's the 21st of April, 1976.
Commencing a run and then perhaps followed behind those horses then on the...
They picked the perfect time because it was the Easter weekend. There were races on the Saturday and on the Monday. So there was not only the official money changing hands that was on the books, there was other money, other cash floating about that wasn't on the books.
The robbery is so well planned, it takes just 11 minutes. The bandits are armed with machine guns.
They made everybody lie on the floor with their face down.
On your belly! Get out!
With more than 30 terrified bookmakers and their clerks lying face down on the floor, the cash bags are moved out quickly.
I have heard it suggested there was inside information in that the consorting squad usually went to these settling days. in a sort of a semi casual, semi-official capacity. They'd be there, they were detectives, they were armed, they were unofficial security. On this particular day, the funny thing was the consorters were called out on a job just before the robbery happened.
Everyone thinks the bandits packed the money in the white getaway van. But more than 30 years later, a lawyer for one of the robbers suggests that's not what happened. Instead of taking the loot down to the getaway van, the gang hastily transfers the bags of cash up the stairs to their secret office. The gang members then gradually retrieve their loot over the following weeks.
Not one solitary witness saw them leave the place, get into a vehicle, carry money out. Not one. We couldn't find one solitary person.
Bennett orders his gang members to hold on to their share of the loot and not attract attention with any spending sprees. Shortly after the robbery, Ray Chuck Bennett's mother collapses in a lawyer's office and she suffers a fatal heart attack. Ambulance officers trying to revive her find her underwear stuffed with $90,000 in cash. The gang's identity soon spreads throughout the underworld because one of the victims, the noted boxing trainer Ambrose Palmer, recognises one of the robbers.
The bloke we'll call the boxer, this robber, said, "You too, Ambrose, put your head down too." And he knew who Ambrose was, and Ambrose knew who he was. Word filtered out about who was in the gang.
One of the robbers, Norman Lee, is said to have invested his share in his Chinese food business.
A lot of the cash did float around. They say that Normie bought a lot of new machinery for his dim sum factory, which was a very notorious factory because it is alleged that the old crook went through the dim sum meat mincer.
While the Kane brothers' violence ensures they're kings of the underworld, Les Kane's violent temper has destroyed his marriage. He's 25 and alone in a nightclub in Toorak Road when he catches sight of Judy Gay. She's a beautiful and vital young woman, and Les is smitten. They marry and have two children, first a daughter, then a son. After the Great Bookie robbery, animosity between the rival gangs reaches a new level as the Canes try to intimidate Bennett's crew.
I think they went after their share of the proceeds, and those people that were involved couldn't have given tuppence with it about the Canes. They weren't frightened of them.
No, no, no. How you'd stand over Chuck Bennett, you know, it'd be a dangerous occupation so far as I'm concerned. Yeah, you'd want to be prepared to die. That's the way I'd be looking at it, you know.
The hostility spills over into a pub fight between Brian Kane,
a venture prick,
and a bookie robbery gang member, Vinnie Mickelson, a former close friend of the Kanes.
And during the fight that took place, Brian had a piece bitten out of his ear and spat on the ground.
A humiliating defeat for a standover man, which could ruin his underworld reputation and be very bad for business. The Kanes are now firmly lined up against Vinnie Mickelson and Ray Chuck Bennett, the mastermind of the Great Bookie robbery. War has been declared, and Les Kane makes it known he intends to defend his brother's honour.
You know, somebody's treading on your toes too hard. You just say to yourself, well, bugger this, you know, my name's Bill and I shoot to kill and you're going to do something about it, I suppose.
The atmosphere is poisonous and each side knows it can't allow the other to strike first. Les Kane decides to move with Judy and their children away from the city to the outer suburbs, but it's not far enough. It's October 1978.
Come on, get into bed and I'll tuck you in.
2.5 years since the bookie robbery. Les and Judy have been out to dinner with their small son, Justin, and six-year-old daughter, Martine.
Tuck him in, love.
Yeah, sure. Ready for bed? Here we go. Good night.
The children are put to bed in separate bedrooms. Les is in the bathroom when Judy turns on the light in the master bedroom. Standing there are three heavily armed men, Ray Chuck Bennett, Vinnie Mickelson, and a man named Laurie Prendergast. Judy recognises them instantly. She's grabbed and pushed into the bedroom, where she throws herself over the little girl.
It's all right, baby.
Shit!
It's okay, Mummy's here. My son! I want my son! My son!
Come on, mate, Vinny, mate.
Free my son! I want my son! Don't you dare hurt my son!
You don't have to do this, mate. You don't have to do this.
Ray Bennett appears and shoves the boy into Judy's arms. Judy is left alone with the children.
Think about it. Think about what you're doing, mate. Come on, think about it. Just...
what you
do? And two of them opened up some machine guns with silencers and killed him. They then dragged his body to the front door, where he bled profusely on the carpet, left a massive bloodstain. They backed his car. He had a Ford Futura, backed it to the door, opened the boot, threw Les Kane's body into the boot, and drove off.
Her husband's body is gone, along with his car. Neither will ever be found.
There was talk that he was taken to a meat crusher up at Mernda and that he was put through the mincer up there.
There's an old saying, catch and kill your own. Well, perhaps we could add a bit more onto that and keep and bury your own.
Judy Kane has been well schooled in the criminal code of silence and sets about removing all traces of her husband's execution. But the underworld knows this murder will be avenged. Unwritten laws protecting women and children have been broken. Both the murder and the brutal retribution, when it comes, change the nature of crime in Melbourne forever. Gangster Les Kane has been shot dead in his family home and his body taken away, never to be found. The murder changes forever the rules of gangland warfare.
Nobody invaded a house to terrorise wives and children. But the night that Les Kane was murdered, all that went out the door. And now it was open slather for people to go into homes, home invasions.
So the Les Kane shooting upped the ante in sort of barbarity. It was regarded as very bad manners by all the old timers.
Judy says nothing to her neighbours or to the police, maintaining the code of silence that she's been taught. Despite dozens of underworld murders in Melbourne in this period, no one has ever given evidence against any of the killers. But all of that is about to change. The day after Les's murder, the head of the homicide squad, Detective Chief Inspector Paul Delanis, gets a reliable underworld tip-off that Les Kane has been murdered.
I got a couple of my detectives to go out and find Judy Kane, and they did, and they brought her into the office.
So, Judy Kane here to see you.
Oh, bring her in. Hi, Judy.
Hi.
Pull up a seat. How are you feeling?
I'm okay.
Well, Judy.
And I said, Judy, I understand Les has gone off.
What do you know about that?
I don't know what you're talking about.
And I said, expanded and told her that the information I had was absolutely reliable and that indeed he had been murdered, and she looked me straight in the face again and said,
Look, I don't know what you're talking about. Les is okay. There's nothing wrong.
Thank you for coming in.
I believe that Brian hinted to her that maybe it wouldn't be so silly to have a word with the law.
Yeah.
Brian reasons that he's probably the next target, but if Les's killers are arrested, they won't be able to strike at him. And if Ray Bennett is thrown into jail, Brian might even be able to strike at him there.
And I received a phone call from one of the boys at the office to say, Judy wants to see you. So I went into the office and saw Judy, and she told me this true story.
My husband
that Les Kane had been murdered.
Did you see who did it?
Yes. It was three gunmen, and they weren't wearing any masks.
She told us who the offenders were. It was Ray Chuck, Vincent Mickelson, and Laurie Prendergast. She was absolutely sure of that. She never had no doubt. She knew them.
We had just gotten home from a friend's place. I tucked in Martine and Jason, and Les went to the bathroom.
Sleep well.
Then I went into our bedroom, and there were three gunmen. They threw me into Martine's room and brought Jason in there as well.
Come here.
Oh! I heard gunshots. And something being dragged along the corridor, and a boot of a car being closed. Then I came outside and went to look into the bathroom. And there was blood everywhere. And there was blood all along the carpet. And then I went outside, and the car was missing.
She rang, she went around to see her father-in-law, Mr. Kane, Reg Kane Sr. And he said, are you being tailed, are you being followed? And she said, I don't think so. And what she did, she went back to the unit with her brother-in-law, and she cleaned up the entire area, the bathroom, the doorway, the whole thing. She cleaned it up, scrubbed it.
From there on in, she was one brave woman.
There are no formal witness protection programs at this time, so Chief Inspector Delanis invents his own. Judy is taken to a secret location and guarded by a senior policewoman. Les Kane's assassins know they're now the most wanted men in the underworld. Ray Bennett and Vinny remove their children from school and take their families into hiding. But police soon find them, and all three are arrested and charged with Les Kane's murder. The day the trial opens, they're provided with extra police protection.
They were fearful they were going to be murdered in the courthouse. Murdered in the courthouse. And they weren't the only ones who thought that was going to happen. So did Victoria Police, because that courthouse was guarded night and day from the roof to the cellar by police officers.
During the trial, cunning defence lawyers attacked Judy Kane's credibility. This tactic, together with the absence of a body, sees all three acquitted.
The smart barristers suggested that Les Kane was here, there and everywhere. They produced witnesses to say that they had seen him here and everywhere, and that the whole thing was just a non-event, her imagination, blah, blah, blah. And the jury didn't believe her. The jury were wrong, very, very wrong. I have a lot of admiration for the woman. She was very, very brave. She had a lot of guts to come forward and make a statement, give evidence at at the coroner's court. She gave evidence at the Supreme Court. She never wavered. Once she made up her mind, she was determined to give the evidence. The jury made a big mistake in not convicting these people. They released them without conviction, but indeed sentenced them to death.
A barrister called Michael Kelly, who went on to become a judge, acted for Prendergast and gave the finest jury address I've ever seen in my life. I've never seen a trial like it before or since, because the three accused men all ran an alibi as their defence to the murdering of Les Kane. And the alibis were complicated and totally believable.
Brian Kane is furious with the jury's decision. He vents his anger at Vinnie Mickelson's lawyer, Philip Dunn.
I was having a coffee in a coffee shop in Carlton. I thought that I was just doing my job and impervious all of this, when suddenly I had a hand go around my throat. I'm pulled off a chair and I'm told I'm going to die. And in that split second, I believed it.
As soon as they're released, Mickelson and Prendergast go into hiding. Their leader, Ray Chuck Bennett, will be the first victim of the revenge attacks in one of the most brazen and shocking assassinations in Australian criminal history. Ray Chuck Bennett and his two henchmen, Vinnie Mickelson and Laurie Prendergast, have been tried for the murder of Les Kane. But with no trace of Les's body, and with wife Judy as the only witness, it's a difficult case to prove, and they're acquitted. Despite getting their freedom, they know that they're still hunted men. Ray Chuck Bennett, who's facing another charge of armed robbery, chooses to stay in prison instead of seeking bail. But he doesn't realise that even inside, he's in mortal danger. Some months after his acquittal, Ray Chuck Bennett is taken to the Melbourne Magistrates Court for a committal hearing. In the holding cells, someone has scrawled,
"Ray Chuck, you'll get yours in due course, you fucking dog."
Strangely, after all the security at the murder trial, this time the police escorting Bennett aren't even armed.
It may just be a coincidence that they were not only unarmed, but they weren't handcuffed to him.
A man in a suit with gold-rimmed glasses and a false beard approaches them.
Suddenly this mild-mannered fella says,
"Cop this, you bastard!"
Shoots him.
"Don't make me do it!
Points the gun at the cop and says, "Don't make me do it." And I think he threatened somebody else that was in the room, another fellow, a witness.
Ray Chuck Bennett, shot through the heart, collapses and dies soon afterwards.
Slow it down, slow your breathing down.
The shooting took place in a matter of moments. It took place despite the presence of police and despite the fact that the city court is straight across the road from the Russell Street Police Headquarters.
I knock at his screams, there were these shots, and then there were footsteps. There were footsteps running, and there were yells and all the rest of it. And it was bedlam.
I can remember everybody being ordered to hit the ground, and so we're all lying on the floor. Nobody knew what was going on. I mean, this is like an attack on the whole system.
There's ambulances and coppers, and the SOG are sent over, and they seal the whole building, and you can imagine.
The gunman makes his escape through a hole recently cut in the fence at the back of the court. He will never be found. With an obvious lack of security, the press has a field day, and accusations abound that Bennett is set up by the police.
Somebody who had access to the police car park and to the courthouse had provided the escape route for the killer.
I don't think police at any stage would get involved in something like that. I don't believe that at all.
Blind Freddie knows that he had to have somebody within the Department of Justice as a caretaker of the building, or somebody that knew the police garage layout. Whether they were police or whether they were officials of the caretaker's position there, I wouldn't have a clue.
The detectives who were escorting Bennett at the time of his murder had told the court they knew nothing about threats or a contract to kill Bennett.
A coronial inquest into Bennett's assassination finds no evidence of police involvement, and it doesn't identify the killer.
More than 50 people turned up for the funeral of Raymond Bennett.
As usual, the underworld is not talking to authorities, but everyone agrees Brian Kane has personally avenged his brother's murder. Vinnie Mickelson's brother-in-law becomes an innocent victim of this gangland war. Before Vinnie goes into hiding, he sells his car. The hard-working, clean-living man is sitting in it when two gunmen mistake him for Mickelson.
The 33-year-old was warming up his car to go to work when he was shot four or five times.
So a father and husband who'd never done anything wrong in his life but have a beer with his brother-in-law who was a crook and buy a car from him, was gunned down in cold blood in his own driveway, executed in a case of mistaken identity.
For Brian Kane, time is running out, and the end, when it comes, will be every bit as sudden and violent as his brother's death. The war between rival gangs of Melbourne criminals has so far featured three terrible murders. Standover gangster Les Kane, Ray Chuck Bennett, the bookie robbery mastermind, and an innocent man killed by mistake. No one doubts that Bennett's brazen murder in a crowded court building is carried out by a disguised Brian Kane, Les's younger brother.
Come that, you bastard!
Soon after the Bennett hit, Brian Kane leaves home. After that, he seems to drop his guard.
Brian Kane got out of a Jaguar motor car. I was walking towards my car. He was inebriated and full of bullshit and bad manners on that night. And I said to him, what's going on? I said, I wouldn't have seen you like this 6 months ago. What are you doing to yourself? He said, I'm frightened of nobody. All right?
Three years after Bennett's murder, Brian Kane is sitting in one of his regular haunts, the Quarry Hotel in Lygon Street.
Had a great time.
He's with a friend, Sandra Walsh, who's carrying his gun in her handbag.
No, you need to do that. I've been telling you this.
Two men wearing balaclavas burst in, firing snub-nosed pistols.
You'll be right soon.
He's hit in the head and chest.
Somebody get the ambulance, someone.
The gunmen quickly disappear, and Sandra is left cradling the dying Brian in her arms.
Two shots were fired and Kane slumped to the floor. He was rushed to hospital but died shortly afterwards.
He had dropped his guard to the degree where he didn't have a gun on him. Should have had it in the front of his trousers, on his lap with a serviette over it, but he didn't. He had it divorced from him in somebody else's control. You don't put a back pocket in a shroud, do you?
Less than a week ago, Brian Kane told Father Brosnan that he wanted him to conduct his funeral service.
He knew he would die before me and told me I was not to praise him or canonise him. There was a side to his life that I didn't know.
One of Melbourne's emerging crime families, the Morans, publicly expressed their sympathy, including a message from young Jason Moran.
Jason Moran, as a little boy, when Brian was shot dead in 1982, put a death notice in the paper from your little mate. Jason Moran grew up to marry one of Les Kane's daughters from his first marriage. And they had kids, and those kids were, of course, present as little fellas when Jason was shot dead during the gangland war.
No one has ever been convicted of any of the killings. But the investigation into Brian Kane's murder continues. 3 years after Brian Kane is killed, Laurie Prendergast is living in an outer Melbourne suburb with his wife and child when he disappears. Vinnie Mickelson also vanishes.
You don't see or hear of him much, but now and again you just run into somebody who knows somebody who's seen him. And he is, if that's true, he is one of the great survivors because all his contemporaries are dead.
The bloody war that kills the Kane brothers and Ray Chuck Bennett has attracted a lot of media attention. The former Painters and Dockers leader, Billy Longley, is in jail when he agrees to an interview with the Bulletin magazine in which he exposes the union and its whole range of criminal activity.
I personally regard Melbourne as the homicide capital of Australia. I mean, I know you get some pretty big outbursts of shooting in Sydney, but I don't think they rank with Melbourne so far as homicides go. In the dock war, there was 40 killed, and I heard somebody on TV saying one night, he said, oh, it would have been more like 60 than 40.
The details of mass murder and organised crime on a scale unknown in Australia sends shockwaves around the country.
Billy Longley was the man that introduced the gun. The gun today, as far as the union is concerned, is completely out.
The union's leader, Jack Putty Nose Nichols, appears on 60 Minutes to deny his union is part of any criminal activity.
Who am I to say what people do after dark? I'm only in charge of this. I'm in charge of it 24 hours a day, but only for union problems.
It's an important issue, and the government is going to have to give it very close consideration.
The Prime Minister, Malcolm Fraser, orders a full-scale royal commission to be headed by the prominent lawyer, Frank Costigan, QC.
Putty Nose Nichols, Jack Nichols, who was the secretary of the association, was subpoenaed to give evidence. And he went out and met a few friends and sort of had a drink with them. And he went up to Albury and said goodbye to some friends. He bought a bottle of whiskey. He drove down the highway in the Wangaratta. He pulled up the car. He drank the bottle of whiskey. And he put the gun to his head and shot himself. So he didn't have to go.
The coroner found by his own hand. And only now, Longley says, he's sorry.
Costigan spends 4 years digging into the union, and his final report is devastating.
They treat the law with contempt and are scornful of its punishments. They treat law enforcement agencies as their enemies. They're motivated by greed and are not controlled by any consideration for their victims. Violence is the means by which they control the members of the group. They don't hesitate to kill.
But you had to be armed in my day. I mean, that's just the way it was. As I said to you before, it was a case of kill or be killed. And if you wanted to stay alive on occasions, you know, there were some places you wouldn't dream of going unless you're armed. Some pubs and beer, you know. There's a tradition in Melbourne of barrels, you know. You'd have a turn to help someone and you'd go there and crikey, there'd be some pretty dangerous blokes at some of those turns. It wouldn't be much use taking your handbag with you, you know, you'd want something a little bit stronger than that.
Among the scams Costigan exposes is the union's role in massive tax fraud, known as bottom of the harbour schemes, worth more than $1 billion. Less than a decade later, the union membership has dropped to less than 1,000 members and it's deregistered. Costigan's report leads directly to the establishment of the National Crime Authority to fight organised crime in Australia. The Kane family survives the deaths of Les and Brian. Their brother Ray Muscles Kane moves to Western Australia, and Les's wife Judy makes a new, quieter life for herself and her children.
The Kanes were one of the great crime families of Melbourne. They were tough blokes rather than money makers. They sort of predated the rise of the drug barons. Soon as they sort of went under, then the crime market was flooded with drugs, drug pushers, big money guys. Guns became a dime a dozen because there was money to pay for them. But the Kanes were really belonged to a fiercer and more simple time of really suburban, inner suburban gangsters. And, you know, they wanted to be the toughest bloke in the pub. When the Painters and Dockers had their big, the dock war, as we now call it, a lot of people, dozens of men went missing, as they used to call it, on the missing list. But you never found out about it. People didn't talk about it. And there were no bodies left lying around. So generally it was all sort of kept in-house.
A lot of things changed to bring kind of the end to that old-fashioned lawlessness, but in its own way then opened the door for the new breed to come.
The lessons that you learn through the Kane era, that money speaks all languages, and greed and ego, the downfall of most criminals. And with the downfall of the Kanes.